Historian Arnold Toynbee once said, "Civilization is a movement and not a condition, a voyage and not a harbor." When it comes to civilizations on century-long interstellar voyages, this is very true indeed. So today we will be beginning our look at generation ships and how they might help us colonize the galaxy. We have 4 episodes planned for that over the next few months. And today, we will begin with the basics, including examining why you would use this approach, and reviewing what the other options are. The origin of the generation ship concept comes from an essay published 90 years ago by J.D. Bonnell, also known for the Bonosphere, one of the space habitats we discuss here a lot, though not as much as the O'Neill Cylinder. At the time of its writing, science fiction was really just beginning to bloom as a genre. Of the big three, Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, and Arthur C. Clarke, none of them would publish a story for over a decade yet. Asimov and Heinlein very rightly were in our first year of SFIA Books of the Month, sponsored by Audible. And as we close out that first year with our 12th winner, it is very appropriate that it be Arthur C. Clarke's 1973 novel, Rendezvous with Rama, which tells the tale of mankind's encounter with an alien generation ship. You can pick up a free copy of Rendezvous with Rama and also get a 30-day trial of Audible. Just use my link, audible.com/Isaac, or text Isaac to 500-500. Generation ships, also known as interstellar arcs, work on the principle that the stars are so far apart that you could never reach them in a single lifetime. And back in 1929, when Bonnell wrote his essay, we did not have any spaceflight, and only very simple rockets and equations for them. That essay, The World, the Flesh, and the Devil, which I'll link below, is ironically one I'd never read till around a year ago. But channel regulars will notice a lot of familiar concepts in their earlier stages there, complete with discussions of sailing into deep space using solar sails. In the absence of powerful lasers or atomic rockets, any such ship, destined for even the nearest stars, would take a near eternity to arrive. A ship moving at just 1% of 1% of light speed would take 40,000 years to reach the nearest star, and that's the kind of speeds modern spacecraft tend to achieve, and what the rocket equation, already known in Bonnell's era, would suggest as a maximum limit at the time. Right from the start, we know about the major problems. Such a ship was in no way possible at that time, 3 years before we discovered the neutron and began considering atomic energy as a power source. There was simply no way such a ship could survive the journey with an intact biosphere. No chemical fuel could keep plants lit and habitats warm for those immense journeys. To add to that, you need a very large ship to maintain any diverse ecology for future colonization, and to support enough people that they didn't all start growing third arms from inbreeding. Many solutions were proposed for this, some effectively abandoning the generation ship notion entirely. But this is when the seed was planted. That, of course, was the purpose, to colonize and seed other planets. As to the why, I think most folks know the obvious ones already. They range from not wanting all of humanity's eggs in one basket, to just an extension of our desire to wander and explore, the pioneering spirit. These all sound good. But there's a big difference between traveling around the galaxy at warp speed and voluntarily getting on a ship that will be the final resting place for you and your next dozen or more generations of descendants. These are trips lasting so long that even if you are the 100th such ship to launch, you still won't have heard back from the first one yet to know if they've succeeded or died horribly. So while it gave us a potential pathway to the stars, it didn't seem like anyone would choose to follow it. Indeed, this was the obvious solution to the Fermi paradox back when Enrico Fermi first suggested it, and he didn't regard it as a paradox at the time. Such ships simply were not realistic at that time. Fermi died in 1954, quite some time still before we even went to orbit, let alone our own moon. So while a species might colonize its own solar system, the idea of getting to others seemed like something limited to science fiction. Yet it gets discussed a lot in science fiction, and with many serious and science-based solutions to the various problems. Many of those, again, didn't involve generation ships at all. We discussed the five major types of interstellar colonization vessels way back at the end of Season 1, and added a sixth variation the following year. In order, those were Methuselah ships, sleeper ships, generation ships, seed ships, and gardener ships. We'll be adding some variations to those as we move through this series, and talking about when or if each of those options, or combination, will be most effective. We will also be asking ourselves, next episode, if a lone ship is really a good idea, or if you should be employing a fleet, and if so, should that be a fleet moving together, or strung out in a long line, with a vanguard arriving first, followed by waves of vessels. But on a long voyage through deep space, with new generations being born, you no longer have volunteers, and many skill sets might be lost. Initially, that was a bigger concern. Remember, Bonal's essay predates any electronic computers. Even once we had them, for most of the 90 years since Bonal's essay, computer hard drives were little better than books at data storage, either in terms of data density or ability to resist damage. So it was thought that generation ships would have to carry real books. But even with modern data storage allowing us to carry the sum of all human knowledge in one's pocket, skills with no purpose can get forgotten and are hard to relearn just from records. There's not much call for a geologist on a space ark after all. Yet with each new advance in technology, new approaches to making generation ships viable or offering an alternative have arisen. So let's review those basic designs and how they vary from a generation ship and why. Each has its strengths and weaknesses, and seeks to address some problem of the basic generation ship or exploit some new technology that's been discovered or proposed since the original concept. The first, the Methuselah ship, approaches it from the standpoint of having life extension technology. It doesn't get around the long time the crew must endure, but it does get around the problem of generations. The people who get on board such a ship can be assumed to be volunteers, and ones with a clear idea what they need to do and the skills and technology for it. Methuselah ships get around the problem of the crew being unwilling after the first generation, or unskilled, because the first generation is still around. Indeed, there may not be any future generations until they arrive. With limited resources on a small ship, breeding more folks on the flight is maybe not a good idea. But if you did, those additional folks or replacements would still have living ancestors who raised them and know what needs doing, all the way till the final destination. Additionally, a Methuselah ship implies a level of medical or nanotechnology that can help deal with concerns about long-term space voyages, both the hazards of space travel and the genetic and ecological issues. Such folks are presumably either genetic wizards or masters of cybernetics and nanotech after all. Our next type was the sleeper ship, which is poorly named in some respects, since you are dead, not asleep, so tomb ship might be more apt, but sleeper ship still conveys the intent. Everybody gets frozen, unless you've got some magical stasis technology, and thawed out on arrival. Or almost everybody does. A ship needing a crew or maintenance in flight might key to a generation ship approach for a small crew with a vast number of frozen colonists. Alternatively, they might wake pilots and maintenance personnel for a few years each, either waking the whole team for a few weeks to assess the current state of the mission and do some repairs, then freezing them again for a few years before waking them again, or keep shifts where a 1,000-year journey might have 100 crew teams, each thawed out for a decade before going back to sleep. Animals and plants for terraforming are kept on ice the whole mission. In this way, the sleeper ship avoids both unwilling passengers born during the flight and loss of skills in future generations. This seems ideal, but for two problems. First, and most obviously, it has been over half a century since the first person was cryopreserved, and we still lack the technology to thaw out and reanimate humans. Incidentally, the first was Professor James Bedford in 1967, not Walt Disney, who was never frozen, but was cremated, and nobody's really sure how that rumor started. As I mentioned back in Interstellar Colonization, the technology to resurrect people long frozen is probably the same as to keep them alive without aging, since it requires massive cell repair, so if you can do a sleeper ship, you can do a Methuselah ship. This does not mean you wouldn't do a sleeper ship, though, as keeping a ship and its passengers alive for the whole trip is demanding in resources and energy, whereas keeping people frozen in interstellar space is rather easy, and such a trip is also presumably fairly boring, too. However, the second problem with cryo is that things which are frozen are not in a magic bubble in which time does not pass. Even ignoring the damage done while freezing, decay still happens. What's more, no matter how cold you make someone, it will have no effect on atomic decay. Many of the substances in our bodies are radioactive, particularly potassium-40, hence the overblown concerns about banana radiation. I've seen some varying figures for the total doses of radiation we get just from our bodies, not external background radiation, but I'll go with the 0.3 millisieverts per year from the Health Physics Society, and it's only about a tenth of the total most of us get from background radiation overall. You need about 10,000 times that to get a lethal dose. However, if you're frozen, isotope decay is still occurring, and without the usual repair mechanisms to keep things in check. Using the HPS data, if you freeze someone for 10,000 years, they'd get a lethal dose, just from the various radioactive materials in our own bodies. So there are limits as to how long you can keep people frozen, unless you are reviving them periodically to fix that damage, assuming you even can. Indeed, space is not exactly known for its lack of radiation either, so your timeline is a lot shorter unless you are very well shielded. To keep people frozen longer, you either need to be able to repair them with nanotechnology while frozen, which might be rather difficult considering nanotech isn't immune to the cold either, or again you have to wake them up and let repairs occur. Which is okay if you're cycling personnel to run and repair the ship, just waking folks every few centuries to do a couple years of work and heal up again before being frozen again. No indefinite frozen voyages, though. Freeze folks for a few million years of travel to another galaxy, and they'll all wake up thoroughly dead. Our third type, the classic generation ship, we'll skip for now. Type 4, the seed ship, essentially is a robot that arrives in a system and terraforms a planet. It can be used as a speedy vanguard to ships with colonists arriving later, or in more high-tech forms, could potentially grow everything and everyone there. Depending on your technology or inclination, it might simply prepare the location for more thorough terraforming, or just growing plants and insects, or even animals, or people it raises and teaches. Having a vanguard is an example of why you might use a fleet, arriving in bits and pieces, and it is likely that even single colony ships would at least send fast probes ahead to do detailed flybys of various planets and to confirm the target is ideal for colonization, or look at some neighboring ones the ship could divert to if it wasn't, or as emergency alternatives. However, a seed ship could potentially grow people without minds, be that clone but mindless bodies, or androids into which colonists' minds could be uploaded. And this brings us to our fifth one, the data ship, which is essentially abandoning biology entirely in favor of simply bringing self-replicating machines and data, including digital copies of minds. These two types, seed ships and data ships, have merged a bit as concepts as technology improved, because a seed ship planning to grow people or build androids is essentially a data ship, and more to the point, information can be sent at light speed, so neither needs to carry much data. A tight beam, high bandwidth laser, can be shot at the destination to coincide with when the ship is expected to have arrived and gotten the basic colony apparatus in place, thus getting around some of the concerns with data storage for very long flights or everything being very out of date when it gets there. Moreover, DNA can be stored digitally and printed, so a seed ship need not carry frozen genetic samples along on its voyage. Of course, these are very tiny and fast approaches, and cheap too. As we'll see as we explore generationships, these are huge vessels, whereas a data ship or seed ship is much smaller. Indeed, a data ship potentially might be as small as a model ship someone would keep on their shelf or mantle. Data can be stored very densely, even when you are including many redundant copies to deal with data decay or damage. And again, a tight beam aimed to arrive from home about when the ship would be in place can get rid of any non-essential data that isn't needed for the trip or initial setup. Either version might begin not by terraforming a planet, but by building a giant receiver dish and data storage banks instead. Indeed, the data ship may be more akin to a von Neumann probe, only instead of building a copy of itself, it builds the needed infrastructure and then builds the colony. It's tempting to think the ship's planetary probes can go faster because they are smaller, but that's flawed reasoning. The energy required to achieve a certain speed scales linearly to mass, so a bigger ship with a proportionally bigger engine and fuel tank can get going just as fast. The real reason your probes can travel ahead faster is because they don't have to slow down, arrive safely, or return to you, while your colony ships need to use fuel to slow down as they near their destination system. Probes can use all their fuel accelerating, do their job of gathering data to send back, and shoot through into space, though they might save a little for a course correction to check out alternate targets further ahead your ship could likewise detour to. Waste not, want not. They take way less total mass to build and fuel, of course, allowing you to build hundreds for every star in the galaxy out of a single, modest asteroid. But they rely on a level of smart automation to manufacture that makes this redundant, too. A gigaton space ark might weigh as much as a trillion tiny data ships, but the asteroid belt, our topic for last week, masses about 3 billion gigatons, enough for 3 billion such ships. And our smallest planet, Mercury, has enough for 300 billion ships, enough for every star system in our galaxy. So mass is irrelevant in this context. And if you've got tiny ships that can colonize whole solar systems, then you can, just as easily, have them rip apart a few large asteroids or moons in our solar system to make a ton of giant ships instead. You also have no need to send a ship to each star, as the first wave can arrive at the nearest few hundred systems and build more of any type, such as data or seed ship. It just builds copies of itself to go to other systems further out, before getting to work on terraforming a planet. Generation ships can do this too, but it's assumed to be a lot slower as they presumably need centuries, if not millennia, of settling their first system before they'd have the time or desire to send out the next wave. Fundamentally, generation ships are self-replicating machines, just as humans are. It's just that neither requires tons of technology we don't have yet, even on the drawing board. This is where our last ship type, the Gardiner ship, comes in. In many ways, it is just a normal generation ship, incorporating some of the other concepts. We discussed this in the Life in a Space Colony series, but it's basically on a long voyage with everyone awake, and with the ability to manufacture goods en route, rather than bringing everything from home. Suddenly, your generation ship is not a one-time use vessel. There's no reason they can't be breeding up their numbers during the voyage. Indeed, we assumed life extension technology was available to it, and so they've got a rising population if they have any kids at all, unlike a generation ship, which can simply limit breeding to replacement levels. They arrive at a system, leave some of their people there while helping the colony get started, and fly off with a full fuel tank and raw materials sourced from that star system. During the voyage, they can turn those raw materials into colonial equipment, and the crew can breed new colonists. Since the ship needs to be able to repair every component of the vessel, they can, much like the self-replicators of data and seed ship versions, actually even spawn new ships or subdivide their ship into two ships every so often, which will head off to separate destinations. With this, you can build rather huge generation ships because you only need a few hundred to be built back here in the solar system to get the whole galaxy settled quite quickly. They won't get it done quite as quick as a self-replicating probe will, but they won't be much slower either. They move at the same speed and mostly just stop for longer, but on century-long journeys between each stop, little difference is made by them stopping for a few years compared to the probe stopping for a few hours, or that the probe can probably decelerate and accelerate quicker. So those are the main alternatives to the classic generation ship. However, a lot depends on what we mean by classic generation ship. The original versions tended to assume you needed millennia just to get to the nearest solar system. We already have designs for ships using current tech we can build right now, albeit for costs that would bankrupt nations, that could get to our nearest neighbors in centuries or even decades. We'll talk about those designs more next time, but they change the dynamics a lot. How fast a ship can go, how long you can keep people and equipment alive and functioning, and how quickly you can build en route or at your destination all heavily influence how you colonize. For instance, with several of these designs, there's no need or point to Earth sending more than a handful of small ships out. Whereas with classic generation ships, you want to send them as far as you can because your own colonies will be a long time growing before they send their own. And you can always get a ship from Earth to a destination faster by sending it directly, rather than by having it zigzag a bit and stopping to do stuff, refueling or replicating and speeding back up again. We also have other advantages that let us make colony ships smaller, and thus let you build more of them. For instance, the big concern originally was that such a ship needed to be big enough to support a genetically diverse ecosystem that wouldn't bottleneck either. For its human crew, we tended to assume a need for thousands of colonists to avoid that. However, in the first place, we could bring along huge quantities of frozen fertilized embryos for implantation. We already have that technology. In the second place, we will most likely have the tech to fix genetic issues that crop up from breeding too closely before we get our first space hulk built. This doesn't mean you don't need or want a large ship with a large ecology on it, and we'll discuss the challenges and solutions of that more in the third episode in this series, Exporting Earth. Keep in mind, though, that even if you're bringing only two of every kind, elephants take up a lot of room. The picture we begin to see emerge, though, is that a realistic generation ship is going to include facets of each of those other variations. It is going to carry large freezer banks, even if you can't revive frozen people. It is going to have self-replicating technology on it, even if it's in a more conventional sense of just having enough factory and industry to make any given object from raw materials obtained on arrival. It is likely to employ a vanguard, even if that's just fast flyby probes to take readings of the system before you arrive, or scout ahead to help the ship avoid dangerous interstellar space junk. It is likely to have huge databanks containing all our art and science and history, and for that matter, digital copies of DNA so they can fall back on those if frozen supplies are damaged or can't store long enough. It isn't likely to make building a big receiver dish its first project on arrival, but only because it will likely already have one, so it can be receiving data from home the whole time. News, technological breakthroughs, new TV and books, and likely intermittent repeats of all essential knowledge in case something vital is lost. Another thing we'll explore more in the fourth episode is that your colony effort is not just limited to the folks on the ship even after it launches. Someone has to keep sending them new info from back home, for instance. That episode, The Million Year Arc, will focus more on the long-term changes of mission and culture on ships, where we'll try to tackle the challenge of keeping a generation ship intact and on mission for a million years. Back home, though, you've got the same problems. You want to make sure your ship isn't reliant on information from home, but you want to have that option. So it makes sense to invest some of your colony ship building funds into creating a trust or foundation that will keep rounding up data and sending it to you. That's not an easy thing, considering how few organizations survive for centuries, and far fewer of those stay on their original mission. Just as an example, a trust set up in the 1500s to ensure funding for colonizing the Americas would probably have had a department dedicated to the shipment home of plundered goods and slaves, and the exporting of missionaries and possibly soldiers to encourage those missionaries get listened to. I think we can assume, if they had existed then, sometime in the last century or two, there'd have been some major overhauls to that foundation. You want that support from home, and you want to pack all the gear you need, not raw materials. But fundamentally, you need such a ship to be as self-contained as possible, able to survive without info from home, and build what it needs for the journey. Moreover, you need to make sure it can recycle everything very efficiently and doesn't leak. This is a problem because everything does leak. You take hydrogen, for instance, the preferred propellant for ships, and fuel too if you've got fusion. It's fine for getting up to speed, but hydrogen is so tiny it tends to escape through materials, much as a chicken wire mesh can keep in a chicken, but not an ant. Think of your party balloons and how they lose their buoyancy over just a few hours. This is a bit of a problem if all of your supplies of fuel to slow down evaporate out of the ship before you arrive. And we've got the same issue with things like air and water reserves. Bigger, thicker ships and new and better materials can help with these problems, as can innovations in improved recycling efficiency, but are unlikely to eliminate them entirely. One of the solutions for this, without giving too many spoilers for our book of the month, Rendezvous with Rama, is to essentially use a sleeper ship on a bit of a grand scale. You send out a giant ship that can support a whole ecology, but keep it all frozen or in hibernation. The book may be 45 years old at this point, but still discusses a lot of the issues with generation ships and space colonization in general, and like most of Clark's work, it's very hard science fiction. Since it's on the older side, and we'll be focusing in this series on methods suggested with newer technology, you can read that to get a fair idea of a lot of the problems envisioned for generation ships that we'll be addressing in the rest of the series. As books go, it's a classic, and it features one of the classic tropes of science fiction. A giant object is spotted entering the system, identified as not being natural, and the brave explorers set off to explore it and unlock its mysteries. Clark writes them well, as the expedition members act like skilled adults, not blundering around stupidly making crazy decisions. That object, Rama, is a giant cylinder 20 kilometers wide and 54 long, a good deal bigger than the behemoth O'Neill cylinders we discussed recently, and far larger than the ships usually envisioned for space travel, and it is spotted entering the solar system at over 10,000 kilometers per hour, which while fast is still only 1% of 1% of light speed, meaning that a journey to even the nearest star would take it many tens of thousands of years. While we will contemplate journeys of that duration and even longer in this series, we will be trying to show how you can do them far faster with more advanced technology. Clark shows us how it might be done with the technology they had back when he wrote it, or at least technology comfortably on the horizon. It's a great book, and considered one of the best by one of sci-fi's legendary authors, and you can get a free copy today of Rendezvous with Rama. Just use my link in this episode's description, audible.com/Isaac, or text Isaac to 500-500 to get a free book and a 30-day free trial, and that book is yours to keep, whether you stay on with Audible or not. Alright, as mentioned, our next episode in the series will focus more on the mechanics of such ships and factors like flight time and propulsion, fleets of colony ships versus lone ships, and more, in Exodus Fleet. But before then, we will look at how a galaxy settled by humanity might look after a while, when we join up again with John Michael Gaudier next week for a two-part episode exploring what a colonized galaxy will look like. For alerts when those episodes come out, make sure to subscribe to the channel, and if you enjoyed this episode, hit the like button and share it with others. And if you'd like to share your ideas on this concept with others who share your interests, you can join in the discussion over at our Facebook and Reddit groups, or our Discord server, Science and Futurism with Isaac Arthur. Until next time, this is Isaac Arthur saying thanks for watching, and have a great week.